Hello and welcome to this episode of Meet the Farmers. Today I'm speaking to Tim May, who is the Managing Director of Kingsclear Estates. And he's based at Pitt Hall Farm in North Hampshire. It's about 2,500 acres, just over 1,000 hectares in scope. And it's a mixed operation, even though mostly we're talking about an arable operation on chalky loam soils. And I really want to talk mostly today about sustainability, which is one of those buzz terms that people have very different views on. But Tim undertook a Nuffield scholarship in 2011 to 2012, and his report was titled Understanding and Implementing Sustainability. Tim, thank you so much for speaking to me today. I usually ask people to start by describing the business and the farm.
I am the fourth generation here. My great-grandfather was a solicitor up in London, and he brought a small bit of land for hunting on. And then my grandfather came and took the farm on as a sort of like a proper farming entity. So we started off with 250 acres of sort of sporting land, and then my grandfather went up to about 1,500 acres, and my dad's added another 1,000 acres onto the farm. So that's just how the farm got to where we are. What's quite interesting, I suppose, because of having that legal background, we've always run as a company. So we've always had sort of a board of directors and quarterly board meetings, and we've always had a sort of a bit of a corporate structure. And we're quite unique, I suppose, in how we operate. So the company owns absolutely no land at all. It's all under a continuous tenancy. That means that my family can borrow against the value of the land. And if that project was to go wrong and the bank were to take hold of the land, they'd only ever be taking tenanted land. So the tenure of what we do as a farming business is completely separate.
What was it like growing up on the farm?
Yeah, when we were growing up, there was a lot of livestock, pigs and dairy cows. There was about 28 people working on the farm, two or three people in the office. So, you know, it was a big operation. I used to have more fun playing on the farm by going up to my cousin's house. They were a smaller dairy farm, and we used to be able to go and build dens in the straw barn and all that sort of stuff, and just brilliant fun. And we couldn't really do that at home because it was a bit more structured, a bit more management and, you know, hierarchy and stuff like that involved. What was quite interesting about growing up was I went to a school called Brynemore School down in Somerset, which is one of the only state schools that's got a farm. They used to go and milk cows and feed pigs and stuff in the morning and then go in the workshops and do all that sort of stuff.
You even did a GCSE
in
agriculture, didn't
you? Yeah.
Which is unheard of.
There's not too many GCSEs in agriculture.
You left Harper Adams in 2004 and then you came back to the farm to manage the arable. You're just in the state of the farm then and your way of thinking coming into the business.
Yeah, so I'd already done about 20 months of travelling, I suppose. At 18, I'd been in New Zealand, Australia for 9 months, and then I did the 2,000-mile harvest in 2001, I think it was. So I kind of had a little bit of a global perspective of what was agriculture was about, you know, in other places. And I came home and we'd sold all our dairy cows, sold all our pigs, and it was 100% arable cropping. We brought our first direct drill in 1996, so we had some experience of direct drilling and stuff, and we still got that experience in our system. But we were sort of like a min-till direct drilling sort of regime. And really the reason for that was because of steel. We could wear a plough point out in 4 hours on our ground and on the flinty stuff. So it was really, how can we reduce the costs of getting seed into the ground and that sort of thing. And the whole concept of soil health and the reason of doing min-till and direct drilling for soil health was a bit limited, I suppose. So then I took on when I came back, I took on another agronomist that understood the system a bit more. And that's when, I suppose, the whole learning about soil health came in. I plugged away a bit for quite a long time. And, you know, still didn't really seem that we were changing that much drastically. And I don't know if I was impatient or what it was. But, you know, we've been doing this direct drilling and min-till. But, you know, we weren't getting the fantastic sort of earth-changing results that are often spoken about when people talk about that way of farming. So, you know, and I often used to say to our agronomist at the time, I had two, one of them was a very sort of much more chemically conventional style. And I used to say, well, this is just ridiculous. Why don't we just put it down to grass and let it do its thing? And no, we're getting better. Just keep plugging away, you know, just keep cultivating it right and we'll make it better. We'll break this ground. And that was kind of the narrative. Yeah. Then was all about, you know, how do you beat nature, I suppose, or make it do what you want it to do. And
And eventually, you put almost half the farm down to Herbal Lays. Whenabouts did that happen, and what was the thinking behind that? Was there a road to Damascus moment that you thought, this is it?
I mean, a lot of people ask me this, and they expect me to say, and they write in their journal and articles that, you know, Tim saw the farm was failing, and there was, you know, tumbleweed about everywhere, and a bit of a Texas cowboy scene. But it wasn't anything like that. As I was doing the Nuffield, sort of get understanding more about, I suppose, the economics of arable farming, the economics of what we were doing, and I suppose the economics of that reductionist mindset, which was basically saying, well, we've got pretty flat yields and ever increasing costs of production, and you know, the price of our inputs aren't really reflecting inflation. If we keep going down this path, you know, we might continue to make the same number of profit. So it might be whatever it is, you know, say it was £100,000 or whatever it is a year. But with inflation running at a much higher rate than what we are led to believe, we're actually doing something less than standing still if we continue just to make our same £100,000 profit each year. So what we need to do is to find growth in our business, and we need to find that in a way that's, you know, not going to cost us a lot of risk. So that was kind of my realization. It wasn't the soil or anything. It was kind of, well, the economic model that we're farming under is pretty well knackered, so we need to change that. At the same time, another one of my Nuffield colleagues, Tom Chapman, wrote a report about mob grazing. And Rob Richmond wrote his report about soil carbon. And when I married those two sort of concepts together, it was really quite obvious that if we could get a grass and fertility building phase back into our rotation, then we should be able to reduce our inputs and then increase our yield. And then when we started looking into grass, sort of came across the Herbal Lays as a grass mix. And, you know, because of the diversity, that really attracted me. And as I understood more about Herbal Lays and how they fitted into, like, the mob grazing scenario, I came across the work of Newman Turner and his fertility farming. And it all kind of fell into place from there, really. We've kind of gotten to this situation where we've now got 4 years of grass and 4 years of crops. So, and every year, a quarter of the grass area will come into crops and a quarter of the crop area will go into grass.
And then the sheep came in... Five years ago?
The first year was autumn 2012 and 2013, which was a really, really, really wet autumn. So when the spring came, we looked and saw that a lot of the fields hadn't really came through the winter that well. So the crops we planted hadn't really come through. And we kind of made the decision that we were going to put the grass in. The sheep, for me, was quite an obvious option because they are low enough cost to get into and the inputs to get into that it was quite good. One of the things I'm pretty aware of from, you know, the reading and stuff I've done is that the winter time is the most expensive time for keeping animals around. So if we can learn how to manage the winter time on grass, so using a grass-based system, then we can, you know, hopefully knock those costs on the head. And sheep, I thought, were going to be the easiest thing to do that, the lower risk thing, doing the least damage to the ground. And if we've got to change numbers, we can do that fairly easily because I haven't got TB restrictions, so we can get in and out of numbers of sheep and that sort of thing. So it was really looking at sheep as a tool. There was a chap grazing sheep on the farm at the time, as in coming in to graze some of the arable stubbles and that sort of stuff. And I could see he didn't have anyone to hand his business on to. He was, you know, I didn't know how old he was, but I thought he's getting to that sort of age. So I just had a chat to him one day. I said, oh, well, what's your succession plan? And he stopped the bike there and then he said, oh, I'm selling up in October. So I said, well, fine, I'll buy you out. So I bought him all his sheep. He had about 1,500, and he was a doctor in grass and management as well. So pretty much it all fell together. I said, right, I'll take you on for 2 days a week for the first 18 months, and you can explain to me and my team how to manage the animals, how to manage the grass, teach us all this sort of stuff.
You're now lambing May time.
Yes.
Is that the same back
then? Yeah. So he was lambing at May time, and because he had his doctorate in grass and management, he kind of knew the value of grass, and he'd been trying to tell farmers, I don't know, back in the 80s, yeah, use grass and how great it was as a feed. He left doing the research station and bought his own sheep because he got fed up with farmers not listening to him. And he used to be lambing, I think, in March time, but that nearly went bankrupt, and then he had to reevaluate his business, and he moved to a May lambing flock, which just cut his labour bills, cut his concentrate bills, cut everything down.
Mm. You visited Joel Salatin in your Nuffield. And he, of course, has this idea of enterprise stacking.
Yeah.
Do you have plans for introducing other stock?
Yeah, I've got the chicken run, mobile chicken runs. I've got pigs at the moment running behind the cows and the turnips. And we've got a pheasant shoot on the estate, and we're using the game cover crops instead of just being a game cover crop. In February time, we've changed the crop we're growing into to fodder beet, so we can then start grazing sheep on it. So basically everything I'm doing is trying to stack and get multiple uses out of that same bit of ground. But what Joel also did was his relationship with his, well, they weren't staff, they're partners. And that's one of my big ambitions, is to have less staff and more partners. And that's what I sort of try to live by. And we now have very few staff. We're using a contractor to do our arable work. But he was a chap that came to us straight from Harper and managed to get himself a tenancy on a local farm. And now we're supporting him, trying to help him grow up. Our shepherd, instead of actually being a paid shepherd now, he's self-employed. We've made him self-employed so that he can go and expand his business. So he's now managing, so he manages our sort of 1,700 ewes. And he's also doing another, he's got 500 of his own, and he's got another 1,200 that he's managing down the road. So he's sort of become more of a partner.
Yeah, so that's a great example here of that social and that economic marrying so well together and building, giving those opportunities. And that's very clear of what you're trying to do.
It's doing that, but it's also allows me to not be a manager and to actually, it gives me more mental capacity, I suppose, so I can actually get on and think about the next project and drive get the next stacked enterprise on the farm and get that set up, instead of getting bogged down with the minutiae of management.
Let's turn towards your Nuffield. For those who don't know, can you just briefly explain what the Nuffield Farming Scholarships Trust is?
My way of explaining it is that it's an organisation run by farmers for farmers. And so what the farmers have done is looked for the people they think are going to be the future sort of leaders, innovators, early adopters of agriculture. And they give them a bursary to go and travel around the world and come back with some new ideas, and then to communicate that to the rest of the industry.
Did you always know that you wanted to try for a scholarship?
No, not at all. I was stewarding for our local farmers club and taking the group of judges around Hampshire looking at farms and just sort of driving around and chatting, and one of the judges was the vice chairman of Nuffield, and he said, "Oh, so what do you do for your personal development?" And I didn't really have an answer to that, and he said, "Well, you really ought to look at doing something like a Nuffield."
And your eventual title was Understanding and Implementing Sustainability. What is your definition of sustainability, or do you think it's useful to have definitions?
I don't think that there is a single definition, because if BAE can have a sustainability policy and their business model is about building weapons to kill people, I can't see how that their social element of sustainability is going to be able to run on the same line as my vision of sustainability. When I looked at sustainability and tried to understand it, I realised that there's a lot of cycles involved. And if you could understand all these cycles and manage them to get you to where you're trying to get to, then you're probably becoming a more sustainable business. So at the moment, we think very, very linear. So you look at employment, it's I pay you, you do a job, you go home. But in a sustainable employment model would be, we share where we're trying to get to. We've got a combined vision. We're working as partners, and we kind of care about the next generation and the previous generation when we're doing that. And then we look at a sustainable money flow. You've got money coming in and then going out straight through the business without any thought about where do we buy our products from and where do we sell the products from. Because if we can link up where we do that buying and selling, we can close the loop and all of a sudden we can get much more economic growth in an area. When we look at ecology, when we think in a sustainable, holistic manner, we recognise that all we're trying to do is manage an ecological process that is trying to get from volcanic rock to deciduous forest. A sustainable business would be something that looks after people, looks after the planet, but really looks after profit. And we can't really be sustainable until we've got sound profit. The other thing I realised was that different countries have a different vision of what sustainability is. So you talk to, in Brazil, you talk to people about sustainability, and the first thing they show you are their social programs, how they educate their children. Each company would educate their kids up to 15 and give them free milk and all that sort of stuff. And that was sustainability for them. You go to England, you talk to people about sustainability, and all of a sudden it's all about pollinators and bees and not really about people. But I haven't actually been to a country and talked to anyone about sustainability and then started talking about economics. It is coming, but it's lagging a bit behind.
What were your personal aims for the Nuffield?
So originally when I went to Nuffield, I wanted to understand about understanding and influencing the value of land, because I thought that our business was going to get to the stage where there were so many people involved in landowners and management and stuff that it wasn't going to be able to get through to the next generation, the generation after. So it was really about, well, how can I add value to the estate and sell it? But I quite quickly realised that there was another way, and this sustainability had, or understanding what these cycles and understanding this sort of stuff was probably going to be quite integral to what we're doing. And I suppose within the sustainability, I thought, well, for me, there's some personal sort of principles that I think if I can instill them in my business, then I ought to be going the right sort of direction. It was about local trade and get ourselves off the commodity cycle. It was about looking at quality and producing a quality product. And I kind of got that from Joel Salatin and their thing, you know, if you can focus on quality, then you ought to have a bit more resilient product. It was about pride as well. And what I noticed about some of the better farms, the farms that were proud of what they were doing and where they were doing it and why they were doing it, seemed to have much more regard for their situation than the ones that were just doing it and weren't overly proud of what they were doing. It was about looking after people and kind of trying to form that, I suppose, cyclical relationship with them. You know, instead of just being an employer, it was more about how can we enhance their lives. And our tagline in the business is growing potential, and how can we grow the potential of people. And then finally, it was about, you know, not expanding and realising that there is a huge amount of opportunity within our own holding. Before, and you know, so we don't need to go out and take on more and more land to become a sustainable business. We could just need to stop and look at what we're doing here today. When I tell you that to people, a lot of people say, oh, it's all right for you because you've got, you know, you're farming this massive amount of area, you're farming 2,500 acres and you've got no worries. And my comeback is, well, yeah, that's true, but I bet there's still something on a 200-acre farm that you could do more. And it's, you know, it's quite a hard thing to say, but the best business I ever saw was running on 2 hectares, you know, and all of a sudden, when you see that, you think, well, hang on, I don't think it is size. I think it's actually looking at what it is you're doing and actually understanding where you're trying to go with your business and understanding your personal goals and what constraints you've got available to you.
Talking about these three pillars of sustainability, the economic, the social, and the environmental, there's a great graphic in the report, which is from Ian Hill, mm-hmm. Managing Director from the beef enterprise in Brazil that you visited. And he starts with financial sustainability, which starts with this idea of better management. And then that leads to profit, which then enables social sustainability, and then that enables investment, which then enables environmental sustainability, and that enables increased profit. And I think that way of thinking, mm-hmm. which is a very, very simple sort of shift in terms of the way of looking at it, for me certainly, that was a great sort of realization.
But it's also it's learning to talk the language that people understand. You know, the business makers, that they really understand. I mean, I'm doing a bit with holistic management, and one of the biggest problems of trying to encourage more farmers into holistic management is that the language is so woolly that it just turns people off straight away. And when you can actually start to put hard business cases like that model in front of hard-nosed sort of business people, then the wooliness of the subject can disappear because there's an actual business case. And that's what's really got to happen with sustainability, holistic management, all these sort of things, regenerative agriculture, is it's got to be about the business case and about the profit.
There's another great sentence in your report, actually.
You've read it well.
Which is, I did my homework. Which actually changed, it made me think about the way that I think about our family business as well at home. And that's, just this, make the most of what we have before looking to expand. Because I know that there tends to be this quite a common tendency, I think, certainly when it comes to diversification, that in order to increase revenue, you look elsewhere. Mm. In addition to doing what you're doing at the moment, rather than starting with what you have. And I think that is absolutely critical.
Yeah, it, and it's again, it's seeing that the abundance of opportunities. I mean, I'm just almost tired with the excitement of seeing the opportunities and the abundant things I could be doing on the farm, and beating myself up for not getting on and doing more of them. And once you can stop and see it, and you kind of liberate yourself from the what ifs and just try something, then the next one's come a bit easier. And I guess being able to stop and reflect and have the time to see what you're seeing and all that sort of stuff. But once you can do that, then that ability to work on your farm comes much better.
And yeah,
I mean, it's so easy for an agent or an advisor, you know, a lot of them doing great jobs, but for them to say, well, we need to get this business that you're running to meet, you know, reduce its costs, you need to do more, because it is an easy solution, but it doesn't deal with the whole picture. You need to actually ask where you're trying to go as a business and a family, and whether you know, one of the things I want is August. I want August back because I've got young kids. And you say that to an advisor, it's not going to fit with what you're trying to do.
Yeah. I mean, how do you manage your time? How do you stop yourself from micromanaging everything?
You have to go through some pretty hard times and then take a bit of counselling and realise that life's not... that you're burning yourself out. And once you get through the other side of that, you realise, well, that's going to happen. With the scale, and I'm quite lucky that I can say, right, the sheep is one man's job and the arable is a contractor's job, and I can then start to delegate that away from me. But that's a big challenge. I hate really being in the office, but I should be in the office much more. And so I've had to just keep getting rid of tasks and getting other people to do them so I can spend more time in the office. And I suppose, I don't know who said it, but from my Nuffield days, I've got this thing in my head of someone saying, just keep cutting things until you can sleep at night. Just keep dropping doing stuff until you've got a decent night's sleep, and then go from there. And I think that's really powerful. And I suppose one of the things with Nuffield is they really want you to leave your business for a chunk of sort of 6 weeks minimum. And they want you to do that so you can learn how to make your business run without you. And once you've been given that tool, yeah, that's life-changing.
What were your key take-home messages?
I think one of the things that was definitely true is that our problems are everyone's problems. Yeah, we've all got successional problems. We're all trying to produce on commodity trades and that sort of stuff, and that's not very sustainable. But there's not one country in the world that's actually making a great profit out of farming. We're all actually on the same stream, in the same boat.
And did it clearly change the way you managed the farm afterwards?
Yeah, Nuffield definitely did it. But I think one of the big things that it did for me was that it gave me permission to think differently and to then act differently. And when I saw my other Nuffield colleagues all doing crazy stuff on their farm, it kind of gave me permission to go and do the same and to get on and do it. If I hadn't done the Nuffield, I'd probably still being an arable farmer and plugging away and moaning about arable prices. And now I'm doing much, much more than that. And I've kind of got that empowerment, so yeah, definitely changed.
What's the future for the estate as a whole?
The future for the estate, we are going to have way more enterprises, so much more diversity. And within those enterprises, we're going to have much more diversity within the individual things. So when we look at crops, we're going to have multi-species of crops in the fields, and we're going to have multi varieties of the species within the crops. So it's kind of all about adding diversity. We're going to be working with way more partners, and the door's always open for more people to come along and come with their crazy ideas, you know, from just foraging or tours or whatever it is that people want to do, then, you know, we're the people to come to. We are going to be having a lot more fun. We're going to be doing a lot more smiling. We're going to embrace holistic management a lot more. I've done a couple of courses, and I'm hoping to take that further and do some more of the certified educating stuff, so that we can become a bit of an example of what holistic management can do.
What do you see as your biggest challenges, and how do you intend to face them?
So early on, my biggest challenge was people. So going through this whole change of strategy and then trying to bring people along with me. You know, we've dealt with that by changing our relationship with, you know, how we employ people, how we deal with people into creating more partners. And probably going forward, one of the big challenges is going to be finding more like-minded people that can see the opportunities and want to drive them. Then I suppose the added challenge is marketing. always will be, but that's something that I think will come by doing more of this, more promotion and more explaining about where we're going and why we're going there, and opening the door for opportunities for people to come along to us and work with them, really.
And lastly, I'm doing this with all the farmers I'm speaking to through these podcasts. We've got a new British agricultural policy coming up in the next few years. There's one thing that you could contribute or suggest to contribute to that, what would it be?
To realise our strength as a trading nation, we have got so much trust. If we say our product is GM-free, or we say it's organic, or we say it's only grown, you know, under red light, or whatever we say it is, internationally people trust us. And I think we could sell ourselves short by not respecting that. So we should be aiming for the higher value sort of niche product on the international marketplace, which will probably be something like organic or regenerative or pasture-based or one of those labels. Because when we go to the international marketplace, people trust it. And I think the worst thing we could do is sell ourselves short and say, oh, well, we're commodity producers and we'll just produce you cheaper wheat. Because how can, you know, our 200-acre farms, 500-acre farms compete against the 2,000-acre fields of wheat? You know, it's nonsensical. So our strength is the fact that people trust what we say we've got.
And that was Tim May speaking from his farm in Hampshire a couple of weeks ago. I drove back to Essex feeling inspired and enthused to look at our own family farm business through different eyes. Good business planning is all about identifying and prioritising what it is that you want. For Tim, I think this clearly means giving himself more time, as well as generating opportunities for others and strengthening the financial, social and environmental sustainability of his farm for generations to come. It's not a model that would work for everyone, but it seems to have injected an extraordinary momentum and energy into this particular business. I wish him well for the future and have absolutely no doubt that Pithall Farm and Kingsclere Estates will continue to thrive. I also want to thank you all for listening to Meet the Farmers and supporting the podcast. It would be great if you could tell your friends and family about it and post it on Twitter or Facebook. I look forward to bringing you conversations with many more farmers from across the UK throughout 2017 and beyond.